Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 325 of the Running Rogue podcast. This is your host, Chris McClung, and I'm excited about today's episode because I've got guests joining to talk about their new book. Tina Muir and Zoe Rahm are here to talk about their new book, Becoming a Sustainable Runner, which comes out next week, if you're listening to this, August 15th. So go either pre-order or get it if it's already out. It's a great book, and it really hits near and dear to my heart as a coach, as a book that provides a roadmap to being a sustainable runner and doing it with longevity and for a lifetime while also having impact on your communities and your climate. So we'll dig in with Tina and Zoe here in just a second. Before we get there, first, want to quickly give a shout out to my sponsors for this episode, BetterHelp and Care Of. Now, long-term sponsors for me, and I'll be talking about those two sponsors during the middle of the episode, as well as giving you offer codes to take advantage of what they have to offer. So, quickly, before we jump in with Tina and Zoe, I want to give introductions. Tina, you already know, she's been on my podcast a couple of other times, last time being on episode 307, where we talked about her resources related to Red S, her YouTube resources related to Red S, relative energy deficiency in sport. She is also, of course, the host of the Running for Real podcast and the Running Realized podcast. If you haven't already checked those out, definitely check them out. Her co-author for the book is Zoe Rahm, who is managing editor for Women's Running, as well as editor-in-chief for Trail Runner magazine. And of course, she's an elite-level trail athlete herself with victories and podiums at a whole bunch of amazing ultra events. So we'll jump in with Tina and Zoe. Here we go. Welcome, Tina and Zoe, to the Running Rogue podcast. Excited to have you both on. How are you today?
We're good. I'm excited.
Amazing. Stoked to be here.
Less than a week from Pub Day, August 15th. We're recording here on August 9th. So excited. It's almost here. Your baby is almost born.
We are doing our best to stay calm, but it's kind of scary when you're like, oh, it's months away. Oh, it's 2 months. Oh, it's next month. And then suddenly you're like, oh, it's here. Where did that happen? So like, it feels like it jumps from like months away to, oh, it's happening right now. So yeah, it's kind of intimidating, but we're doing our best.
It's here. It's exciting. I'm excited to chat with you guys about your book, Becoming a Sustainable Runner. I wanted to start though by talking about, and you give a little bit of color on this in the book, in terms of how you guys met each other through direct message, talking about composting. But I wanted to know how that relationship progressed to the point of wanting to be co-authors of a book.
Ooh, Zoe, you go.
Yeah, well, so yeah, we met, we do talk about this in the book. And I think that it is kind of a nice story because I think it speaks to the fact that like, if, you know, it can be hard and scary to make friends as an adult. Particularly, we became friends during the pandemic, which was not a time I was meeting a lot of real people out in the real world. But I had, you know, long been an admirer of Tina's work and had just kind of been creeping. And I wanted to take that, relationship, you know, sort of like out of the comment section and into real life. And so we started talking. And I think something that I really gravitated towards in Tina is, while I had done a lot of environmental work in my storytelling and journalism, I hadn't done a lot of more advocacy and organizational work that Tina had done. So I was really eager to learn from her because she was really stepping into that part of her career in terms of like her consulting with organizations and race directors and events to help them take their sustainability practice kind of out of the realm of theory and into like the realm of like evidence-based sort of like tangible action. And I really just wanted to learn from her. And I thought that it was kind of a beautiful friendship that we came into with like really not a ton of overlapping skill sets. Like, we had a lot to learn from each other and a lot to share with each other. I feel like that's kind of a really amazing and beautiful place for something like a book to be born from.
It is hard to make adult friends.
It is.
Thanks for acknowledging that. Tina and I are adult friends as well.
Yes. Yeah. I can't even remember how we met. Oh, I think it was through this podcast, wasn't it? Years ago. Yeah.
Oh, you and I? Well, yes, that was the first time, but we didn't really actually develop a relationship till you came to Austin and we hung out, and the rest is history.
Mm-hmm. And I love that. And now it's my third time here, so I'm excited to be a returning guest. Yeah, and I want to add to that that, like, Zoe mentioned there that we didn't have a lot of overlapping and we had a lot to learn from each other. And like, Chris, this speaks to you and I too. And I really believe this is one of the most important things in those adult friendships, is surrounding yourself with people who do help you to grow and do want the best for you and do believe in kind of always striving to just do a little bit better each day. That's not trying to be perfect. And that's the whole premise behind this book, is not trying to be perfect environmentalists, not trying to be perfect, nail every single race runners. But also in our friendships, like who you surround yourself with. And it really was such a glaringly, as Zoe said, beautiful example with us of, you have two people who to the outside world might be shoved in the same box of those two care about the environment, but we really kind of filled in each other's voids and just allowed each other to really like shine and bring out the best of our messaging and merge our messaging so that it came out in this very clear but detailed way that is, you know, related to a very, very important topic that often feels overwhelming to people. So it was really a good representation of what the book is about itself.
I would also say that authenticity is probably an also key part of adult friendships. And from what I know of both of you, what you see is what you get. And that's a magical part of being able to connect through this conversation. So how did it go from mutual respect, interest, also understanding the interplay between sustainability, environment, and the running body, to actually a book? Because that's a much bigger step.
Yeah, I think Tina had, like, really, this is where she kind of swooped in as the ideas machine here.
I mean, I think anyone who knows me even a little bit knows that I'm always juggling about 15 things at the same time. Chris, you probably know that well as well at this point. And I had been asked a lot about how I'd made the shift within my own running from elite runner to kind of finding joy in running, but a more sustainable approach to running. And so that had very much been on my mind. Environmentalism had always been on my mind. And I did get connected to a publisher through Nearly Spence Gracie, Human Kinetics. And they, you know, I talked about wanting to write about these things and they were like, yep, absolutely, let's do it. But I knew that I, as we talked about earlier, there were some things I couldn't speak to. There were some things that I didn't feel confident on. There were some things that I felt like I needed someone who really understood it and got it. And Zoe and I, during this time, had come into this friendship and I just had this gut feeling that we would work really well together. And so, yeah, I am looking outside right now where I was walking around nervously, like almost asking her on a date, like, will you write this book with me? And she was like, yes, absolutely.
Yes,
and
then, 1,000 times, yes.
So that's kind of how it came together. And it did work exactly as we hoped. Like, we really did allow each other to pull the best out of each other and also make our writing find this really amazing middle ground. Zoe was used to writing articles, you know, word limit, got to keep it to the point, very not impersonal, but very like
pretty, you know, not super emotive. I would say that's a fair assessment.
Yeah, and whereas I was like too fluffy the other way. And so it allowed us to find this middle ground where it makes these messages digestible, but also informative and detailed and important. So yeah, it worked really well.
What was the process? I'm curious, how did you actually do it together?
Yeah. So it was really important to us that the book, outside of the like sort of like offset sections that make it really clear that one author is speaking, we wanted the book to really be reflective of like a true sort of collective voice. So what we would do is one writer would start a chapter and then we would switch so that like we could make sure like, okay, that I would never in a million years say that, or like, I feel uncomfortable with this, or like, oh yeah, let's, this is awesome, let's just tweak this. And there wasn't like a ton of stuff that I feel like we had to like wholesale change, but it was kind of more of like a, like smoothing rocks in a river sort of situation, mm-hmm. and making sure that things just felt authentic to the collective voice, felt authentic to our vision. Because I think that, you know, while Tina and I can sometimes differ in approach, the thing that really made this project work is that our values are absolutely the same. And so it was more like having this kind of place of trust where it was like, again, like maybe the way we might approach these things would be different. The destination was totally clear. And like, we did some like pretty honest talks about like, okay, what do you actually want out of this? What do you like, what is your core message? What are your values in this project? How does this project sort of bring those values into the world? And because we had so much clarity around those kind of like tougher conversations up front, everything else just kind of felt like making sure that these sort of little tributaries flowed into the place that we wanted them to flow.
I love the river and the rocks analogies there. Well, it came off well, I would say. You know, I guess as I was reading the whole book, I kept looking for those almost voice changes that you would see. And obviously you had it within the gray boxes where you're telling your individual stories. But beyond that, it was all seamless in that it seemed like even though two people were writing it, it came off with one voice, which I think is probably really hard to do when you're trying to write something together. So kudos to you guys on that. I want to jump in now to the content itself. You know, the book is divided into three parts. You talk about sustainability related to your body, to your community, and then to the environment, and hit on each one of those in turn. So we'll just go in sequence. But one of the big overarching themes across all three is this idea of taking the long-term view. And at least as it relates to the body, as someone who is a coach, I find it hard for people to separate a long-term view from this idea that that is somehow sacrificing short-term results. And so they're always constantly seemingly making those trade-offs. If I push, you know, with the short-term view, I can get what I want, versus if I have too long-term view, then I don't necessarily have the patience to wait for that. And so I guess I would love to get both of your perspectives on this. You know, you, Tina, coming from the elite road running world, Zoe from, you know, the trail world. How do you think about that trade-off, and how would you convince someone to say, no, the long-term view is actually the better view or results as well?
Well, I want to first take a moment to say thank you, Chris, because when I sent you one of those chapters related to that, you gave some really good feedback that were things both of us had overlooked, but were really important in this. So I appreciate your coaching insights that you supported us with. But yeah, I mean, for me, I had crashed and burned out of the sport. I had taken the short term. I mean, in some ways, I'd taken the long term approach, but not intentionally, in that it took me 14 years to get my Great Britain jersey that I really wanted. But then it was always, and especially towards the end, just about race. Like I'd lost the process along the way. And so I just crashed out of the sport, because it's not sustainable for us to simply be thinking, okay, race in 3 months, I'm going to think about the finish line, and then I'll think about the next finish line. That's never going to last. But I also, I tried then, it took me a few years to find a place where I felt comfortable with being able to race at all. For a few years after I did that, after my kids, I tried to race and I just couldn't let go of the competitiveness in me. So I was trying to grit and dig down and do what I'd always done, but it wasn't coming together and it was making me feel terrible, like not just physically, but emotionally too. And so for me, I realized in that moment that I can still try hard. I can still do the best that I can for my life situation, whatever that looks like. But the best way to go about it was to take this approach that I wanted to be a lifelong runner. I wanted to be someone who was in it for many years to come. And I had already made that mistake. And I think many runners get caught up in that, thinking that that's the only way to do things, is to, like, if it's not working, dig deeper. If it's not coming together on race day, try harder. And so hopefully with this, we try to get the message across that if your running just becomes about trying harder and harder and harder, which it often does, not only are you not going to reach your goals because you're putting too much pressure on yourself, but also you are going to lose most of the beauty about the sport because you're just, you've lost the process along the way, which is actually where we do most of our learning and growing as humans. So for me, it was more of a personal perspective. I know Zoe obviously is a coach herself. And so she's got that angle that you have, which I think is helpful for you know, runners listening to this who haven't been in that situation I have.
Yeah, I definitely think like, and this is something I feel a lot in my career as a writer, even though I'm, you know, relatively young, I struggle with feeling like I'm only as good as the last thing I wrote. And I always have to remind myself to zoom out and that like the, you know, the true measure of my achievement in that arena is, you know, sort of in like the assemblage of my work rather than just like a myopic view of like one piece, one day in my life. And I think that so often people take this sort of like narrow short-term view as a way of like not getting vulnerable and of like not actually being brave enough in that moment to kind of see their potential long-term, because your potential is never one day, one race, one marathon, one 5K. It is always, always, always in the broadening of your sort of like athletic horizon. And I think that it's, you know, so much easier to just like make it a referendum of one day, pass, fail, than it is to like, you know, do this kind of more difficult and more nuanced thing, a kind of radically reimagining what that success could look like with sort of a longer view. And I think that if you think that your goal is just one day, one race, I think that you're sort of like underselling yourself. And I think that a lot of times people do that because they're just not brave enough to sort of like look at this larger measurement of success, of this like sort of more mastery approach than just like, you know, taking a snapshot of your career as being one day, one race. And I think that anything that's really worth doing takes a lifetime, a career to do.
Well, you talk about one day, one race. You tell the story of DNFing at Leadville in the book, which I think is a powerful example of this concept, which is this idea that you were not a quitter, right? That day was about your body failing in a sense on you. And that's probably not even the right way to put it, but you were in a dangerous health situation. You had to stop in order to get through it, but that didn't define you. So how do you take a moment like that and see beyond it and say, no, I'm not a quitter. I am actually somebody who did the right thing on this day, made the right choice for myself and my health, and lived to fight another one.
Yeah. I had actually, before that race, I had had a guy that I was like kind of friends with telling me like, you know, if you quit once, it just gets easier to quit all the time. It kind of becomes who you are. And that's just not correct. And I think that like there's so often this sort of like cultural stigma that's based in fear around quitting, fear around not believing in your capacity to make discrete decisions based on the best available information at the time. And the best decision to make when you have hyponatremia, which is what I was going through at Leadville, is to not, you know, run until a kidney gives out. It is to not put search and rescue personnel in additional risk. And I think that, again, like so often, like our vision of quitting is like so steeped in the sort of like cultural obsession with like you're either a success or you're a failure. And like it's black or white, it's either or, and nothing. Like, and I think that the more that we embrace a more nuanced understanding of failures, like, okay, what did I learn from this experience that's going to help me succeed the next time? Like knowing that not everything is pass fail. And I think that that's also a much braver and bolder way to view our successes as well. Right. Like if I, you know, go out and I do win a race, like I wouldn't say it's as successful if I didn't feel like I competed to my potential, if I didn't learn something that I could apply down the line. I think we really all have to get a lot more sort of like granular with our assessment of like what the actual meaning behind these events is. And the meaning is the meaning we make, right? And I think that you just have to sort of learn to read your successes and your failures in a way that feeds a narrative that will help you succeed more down the line, rather than sort of like casting it as this like all or nothing, like pass, fail, good, bad, sort of like victory, failure, sort of like, you know, view of the world that I think a lot of times propels people to make dangerous and harmful decisions about their physical and mental health.
In the moment, in that situation, did you have all of that wisdom?
Oh no, I was like 24. Definitely not.
So what was your reaction in the moment relative to those thoughts? And then how did you grow to this place of saying, you know what, it was actually the right call and I'm okay?
Yeah, I think like I didn't have the language for it at the time, but I did have a feeling. And the feeling I was kind of like carrying around in my heart was different than how people were reacting to me. Like after I would tell people I had DNF'd Leadville, they would come up to me and they'd be like, oh my gosh, I'm so sorry. It must be so hard. Are you doing okay? And I was like, no, I'm like totally fine. Like, and honestly, I was fine. I had really put myself out there in a bold and brave way. And that was how I was measuring success at that time. And so like I checked the boxes that mattered to me. And I found it kind of strange how incurious people were about how the outcome sort of delivered on my expectations and how they only assessed it according to how my outcome sort of was in line with their expectations and values. And so I think, you know, it just really came from like this sort of like naive but wonderful place of like, I knew what my values were and I was standing in them at that time, and other people were like sort of treating me pitiably. And I just like knew in my heart of hearts that wasn't that like wasn't really resonating with me. So I think it was just like lean, like really, you know, like kind of a keen young person's understanding of like, no, I know how I feel about this. And I can tell by the way that you folks are sort of interacting with me that you just need to, you know, maybe do some more investigating or approach my values with a bit more curiosity.
That's interesting. One time I had to walk the last 5 miles of the Boston Marathon because I had a stress fracture in my heel that I couldn't run on in the moment. At least I didn't know the injury, but I knew I couldn't run, that it felt like the wrong thing to run. So I walked the last 5 miles, ended up with my personal worst marathon time. And afterwards, even to this day, people ask me if I needed redemption from that moment. And my, what I've grown to understand in my reaction to that day was that I didn't have anything to be redeemed. Like I actually gave everything I had on that day, and that's just what I had. And so in many ways, I was at peace with it before I even finished the race because I had 5 miles to process it. But it is interesting, this idea of how you define success. And I think sometimes we carry around baggage that we don't need to carry because, and again, in that case, I didn't need to be redeemed for anything. I did what I could on that day, but it is interesting that that's not always what people see from the outside.
Totally. And life is not a John Wick movie. And if you're using like sports events as a mechanism for, you know, caring for an unmet emotional need, I would just say like, there's other ways to meet that need that don't involve bodily harm and, and you can still do the running thing. That's awesome and great. But I think like assessing like, okay, is this coming from a place of I have an unmet emotional need? And often I think like, you know, best case scenario, performing from that place doesn't lead to the best athletic outcomes, and B, can actually lead to some pretty detrimental like mental health and physical health outcomes. So like revenge, sort of those sort of narratives that like play really well in Hollywood are often like very terrible places to make athletic and like personal life decisions from.
Completely agree. Stepping away from the interview for just a moment, I want to talk about my sponsor for this episode, BetterHelp. They're now a long-term partner of mine, and I'm excited to be working with them. They are the largest online therapy provider, and they're there to help you basically find a map or a roadmap when you need to navigate some of life's toughest challenges. I've certainly had that in my own life, particularly when I was grieving a loss from a very, very close friend back in 2019, was having trouble figuring out how to navigate my emotions and process those emotions and that grief in a way that would allow me to move forward and to find productive ways to channel the feelings that came with that grief. So whether you're dealing with a tough, tragic loss like I was, or perhaps it's just a small challenge or issue in your everyday life that you need help processing, BetterHelp is there for you. You can go online, It's really easy to find a therapist. You just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist. And then, of course, you can switch at any time at no additional charge. Once you get matched, then you can set up a virtual consult from inside your home or wherever is convenient to you to connect with that therapist and get that roadmap to process whatever you might be processing in life. So let therapy be your map with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/runningrogue today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/runningrogue for 10% off that first month. Go check it out. Now let's jump back in with Tina and Zoe. Going to you, Tina, bringing you in. Another theme that came out in this section about sustaining for your body is this idea of the seasons of life. And I know you've had many seasons already in your running career and still evolving those seasons. But I like the idea of thinking about it in that way because it's true. It happens. You know, life evolves. And as life evolves, your running journey will evolve. And you're not missing anything when you're taking a little bit of time perhaps away while having a family or prioritizing career in a different way or deciding that there's a period of time where you aren't as motivated by certain goals on the road as you were at a different time. And those seasons are all beautiful in their own way, and it's okay to let them flow and process, you know, as you want to experience them. So talk about that in that concept and how it's manifested for you.
Yeah, it was really important to us. I mean, it ties to what we were talking about, what you two were talking about just there in terms of like perfectionism. This was another theme we had going on throughout the book, and it relates to what you were just talking about there. It also relates to this in that we feel we're in a culture, we talk about this a lot, of we feel constantly like we're not enough. Everything we do is not enough. And that redemption you were just talking about, same thing, that we feel we got to make up for it because what we did wasn't good enough. And so Zoe and I really tried to challenge that in the book. And that relates to this because, you know, when you are going through a major life stress, like moving, or as we said, having a child, going through a divorce, moving a loved one into, you know, hospice care or something, you have to adapt what running is going to be for you. If you like are dead set on like, well, I had my goal for here and I'm going to go ahead with it, I'm going to channel ahead, I'm going to get my training in, you are going to end up either burning out or injured. And I'll be honest, like I am walking that line right now. And as is Zoe. With this book launch, we both have running goals that we want to achieve this fall. We are both kind of playing a bit of a game here of trying to get ready for these races. But recognizing that we have this big thing happening as this book launch. And so I mentioned that because the reason this book is called Becoming a Sustainable Runner is because each of these concepts we too are working on. But we wanted to get the point across that it is okay if you are going through something stressful or something big is happening, or maybe it's just a period of life where you, as you said, you don't feel motivated, and it's okay if you just decide to run easy every day for 40 minutes every day rather than having workouts or having long runs or having something to train for. That to have running be that loyal friend to you that goes with you as you're going through these various parts of what life happens to bring to you. And it doesn't always have to be about the same thing of train race rest every cycle around. And we really try to get across the point that stress is stress. It doesn't matter if it's your running or your stress at work or your family life, all of those things add up. And as much as we are stubborn runners and we might want to try and barrel our way through, I'm going to get my training done no matter what is going on, it is going to add up. And it is going to not only probably leave you, as we mentioned, you know, in one of the states of overtrained or overreaching or injured, burned out, or sick constantly, but it's also going to suck all the fun out of it, because now the one thing that should be joyful for you, the one thing that for most people is a hobby, now becomes another check on the to-do list rather than about, you know, what is so much more than that. So it's difficult, and you may want it to be a big part of your life, even during stressful periods. And we did give suggestions for that. If you are a constantly hectic, busy person and you have a big race that you want to train for, you can do it. But you need to be strategic in how you're doing it and then make sure you prioritize the other parts of your life in other times of the year. So we're both learning ourselves, but we also really wanted to get across, again, that point of perfectionism. If you try to be perfect or nail everything, you're just going to feel like a failure and you're going to end up miserable. So,
yeah. I mean, it would have been great to publish a book that was like, and we hacked it, we figured it out. Here are the three secrets to decluttering your life and reaching all your athletic goals from two women who have conquered it. You're welcome. One of us is a working mom, so got that. But I think a lot of our smart readers would have immediately identified that as being bullshit. And so we wanted to write something for the smart folks who know that there's no secret and know that there's no way you can like life hack your way out of it, but who were hungry for a thoughtful framework to reassess their priorities and values along the way.
Yeah, I like to say you can only train as much as you can recover from the training. And if you have a heavy stress period, we don't often give ourselves enough grace during those periods, then you're not going to get where you want to be, or you're going to end up in a situation injured, burned out, overtrained, et cetera, if you don't give yourself that grace. But it is so hard to do it. It's so hard to do it. I think the other thing I like to remind people is that you have a lifetime. It doesn't have to happen right now. And I have plenty of people that I coach that have these seasons of life that are up and down with their training for whatever reason, and they still come back in periods that are lower stress and crush it. So you can always find that next season that might be different.
Yes.
Tina, for you, what does it look like? What are the hardest trade-offs for you to make when it comes to balancing busy life, kids, podcast, publishing, and trying to race?
I think for me, what it looks like is starting to sacrifice sleep for these things. That's really where I start to get myself into trouble when I start, be honest, last night I couldn't sleep because I had things going around in my head. I got up at 11:30 and started well, here's the thing that's embarrassing. I started writing emails to schedule to go out to this today because I didn't
so
want people
wouldn't know.
Yes, and people weren't like, what is she doing sending emails at 11:30 at night? Like, literally, that's it. You know, I was embarrassed that I was doing that. But so for me, it's when it starts to sacrifice sleep. And I say that in terms of not being able to fall asleep at night, but also getting up earlier and earlier and earlier to squeeze in things. So I find it very difficult, as you talked about, Chris, and I know you do too. And we've all got so many things we're trying to juggle in the air. One thing I've been trying to remind myself is, like, at the end of the day, all of this is running. This is not, I'm not an emergency room doctor. the world will be okay if this book doesn't get out in the way that I maybe wanted us to be able to get it out there. I think for me, the biggest gift is trying to give myself the grace within my own running, because I had these high intentions. I am training for a race at the end of October, and I really, I had a conversation with a good friend about getting up over 70 miles a week, which compared to 90 plus what I used to do, sounds like a piece of cake. But it's not quite as easy as I remember it being, at least, you know, in the life stage that I am in. And so while that competitive side of me is like, I said 70, I need to get to 70 right now and stop slacking, I have to also accept that it may just be 60, and that is okay. That's the, as we talked about earlier, that's the best I can do for right now. And so, yeah, it's tough, and I'm finding it hard to juggle all the things. But yeah, as we try to make the message in the book that all you can do is the best that you can do with your situation, and you've got to try and give yourself grace with that.
Thanks for the confession about the emails, the nightly emails.
I know.
So bad. Zoe, going to you, one of my contributions to the book, I got to help with chapter 5 and do some editing, got some quotes in there. First time I think I've ever been indexed in a book, which is exciting.
Cool.
But one of the things that I say in the book is that most of us measure ourselves by the wrong things, which can lead to things being unsustainable. We give the example in there of measuring yourself by your pace on your easy runs versus perhaps going slow enough on your easy runs, actually measuring it the other way. So for you, as somebody who I believe is training for 100 miler, Run Rabbit Run, is that right?
Yep.
Mountain 100 miler, serious, yeah. Mountain 100 miler. Steamboat. What do you find is most difficult in terms of you measuring yourselves on the wrong things? Where do you struggle with that?
Yeah, I mean, everywhere, right? Because our culture is so invested in selling us all these like fancy new yardsticks that we'll never measure up to, so that we'll continue to buy fancy new yardsticks. My watch can give me 1,000 different data points that don't really help me make more informed and productive training decisions. So like I, even though I have a very fancy watch, have to like increasingly just like take all of the metrics off it because they're just like unimportant in that they don't give me actionable information that helps me like day in, day out, like make better decisions, recover better. What I really need is a watch that just gives me a thumbs up every time I go to bed at 8 and like every time I do a protein shake, that's just like, go girl. Because those are like, you know, making sure that I get in the sort of like recovery nutrients I need. Like, honestly, if I could reverse engineer a watch that every time I turned, like every time I said no to someone, it would like cheer for me. because like that is what I need. And I know I tell people no when I'm standing in my integrity, when I'm standing in sort of an empowered place and sort of like owning agency over my time and energy. And if, I mean, the end all be all of so many of these measurements is to drive us not towards more empowered, autonomous decision making, but is to drive us into insecurity so that we can continue to like push ourselves and consume at an unsustainable rate, right? So I think it's so much for me, it's about curating measurements in my life that actually help me inform better decision making. So for me, that is how I feel like mentally and physically. Do I feel recovered? Not really like, you know, spending too much time stalking myself on Strava, making sure I feel like I'm showing up in a healthy way in my relationships, making sure like, you know, and I think so many of the things that tell me I'm on the right track are like actually harder to measure, right? Like my watch can spit out some black box generated recovery score that I don't understand. It doesn't mean a whole lot to me, but like, I know how it feels, even though there's not like a number I can put on it, to not feel like, to feel like my time is my own and I can take the time I need to recover, that I can like cook a great meal for myself and my partner, that I can take my dog on a walk and it doesn't feel like a stretch or a strain. And I sort of have breathing room in my life. And those things are really hard to measure. So I think it just takes a lot of time and self-awareness to discover kind of like what those metrics are for you, and just sort of divesting from the metrics and measurements that don't serve you. And at the end of the day, tend to primarily serve other people's ends and interests. So I think it's all about deciding what measurements and metrics actually matter to you and which ones incentivize better decision-making on your part, and pushing out anything that's serving someone who's not you.
Yeah. And part of that is just listening to your body, listening to how you feel, which is really hard to do. Yeah. Yes. When your watch is telling you training status unproductive or whatever.
Yes, fitness declining. Yeah.
Yeah, fitness declining. Which, you know, I've turned all those things off and my chorus just tells me goal achieved when I finish a run, which is funny. It's funny as someone who's a coach who also knows all the things that we're talking about. The tiny bit of joy when my watch tells me goal achieved, that is so subtly, not subtly even, actually dramatically more powerful than seeing training status unproductive on my watch. Like, it makes actually a massive difference in my mental health, even though it's such a small thing.
I know, but I used to have matter. Like sort of like a wearable recovery tracker, and I had to Marie Kondo that right out of my life because I found it, again, it wasn't actually giving me information that helped me make better decisions. And it wasn't like I started getting stressed. Like my stress would be high because of things outside of my control, and I would start to feel stressed about that. So it kind of became this sort of like feedback, like negative feedback loop. And I was like, well, I can at least like, you know, there's some things I can control, and this is in that category. Some things I can't control. You know, I can't dictate everything that goes on at work. That's going to be what it is. But if this wearable is making me feel stressed and not in a way that, like, again, drives better decision making, then I need to just yeet that out of my life.
Yeah, I got rid of my Oura Ring for that exact reason, which is hard to do in a world where we're constantly told we should be measuring everything.
Yeah.
Switching gears, bringing Tina back in, something I learned in the book that I appreciated was about this organization called Health at Every Size, which is an organization that essentially tries to debunk the idea that small, thin bodies are healthy bodies, and that there are a lot of healthy bodies in a lot of different shapes and sizes. And that's a beautiful thing and something that should be celebrated not only in our sport, but in society and healthcare in general. So speaking on that topic, and I know you're somebody, Tina, who's super passionate about it and passionate about dealing with the potential ramifications of people that are struggling with body elements and image. Talk about Health at Every Size and how you think health, weight, and performance are interconnected in ways that are different than maybe society would tell us.
Yes. No, this is definitely an area I feel very passionately about. And the reason for that is because people may know if they, you know, heard me on your podcast before, in terms of I was someone who really struggled with body dysmorphia. I would stand on the start line and feel like I was the big one. Even though when I look at pictures of myself now, I'm like, oh, girl, what were you doing? Like, you are like the same or smaller than everyone else. Like, you just realize how out of touch I was from my own self. And I do think there's so much commentary that tells us that thinner equals faster, thinner equals better, skinny equals best. That Health at Every Size, what they're doing is just one example of this movement that is happening to understand that not everyone needs to look the same, and it's not healthy for everyone to look the same. And it's actually, in many cases, really damaging. Towards the end of my career, it became that was more important than my performance, was the way that I looked. And so I do feel like, and the biggest thing with that is that people often think of red S relative energy deficiency in sport, which Chris, you and I talked about in detail in the past. People think that is for pretty much just young, skinny, white women. But actually, there are no set variables or factors. It can affect literally everyone, all genders, all shapes, all sizes, all ages, all backgrounds, everything. All of us have equal risk of this, but the one thing in common is that people who are struggling with red S are all not taking in enough calories for what their body is doing. And so by trying to force us, our bodies, into unnatural sizes that are not right for us and our genetics, we are not only sacrificing our performance, but our long-term health as well. And while people think of amenorrhea or not having a period, there's actually a lot of other effects that are really damaging, like people mistake Raynaud's, so not having good circulation in your hands and feet, constant stomach upsets or GI distress. Insomnia is another common side effect. It can go on and on. And all of these things can easily be written off as, oh, I'm just tired, or oh, I just get cold easily. But they are things that seriously affect quality of life. And so we really wanted to make sure that we got across the message that anyone, regardless of how fast you are, how many miles you run, your size can be affected by these things, and it will make your life quality go down drastically. But the more we can learn to embrace and love our bodies for whatever they feels right for them, the better we're going to feel in every area of our life. And yes, if running is important to you, performance, that is definitely going to be best when you're not trying to jam your body into a shape that it just doesn't fit. So I don't know if that answered your question.
It does. Yeah. And I think, you know, it's related to the running. It's also even broader than that. I was looking at their website and just reading some of the things they're advocating for, particularly on the healthcare side of things and making sure that all body sizes get access to equal healthcare in a system that is largely geared towards those that are in smaller, thinner bodies. But, you know, metrics like BMI and just pure body weight, as well as body fat percentage, in many ways, a lot of them are dated as it relates to how we think about health and those metrics. And I think that's an important message as well, beyond just the idea of running performance and those metrics. So the idea of disconnecting those ideas, I think, is really, really important and something that's fundamental in the book.
Mm-hmm. Totally. And I think something that, I mean, as a, you know, someone in the space that frequently covers these issues and is always really interested to see how folks talk about them colloquially as well, the majority of folks who meet the definition of a diagnosable eating disorder are in larger bodies. And oftentimes those go underdiagnosed because medical health, like our healthcare system, is so premised on this like myopic vision of what it means to be diagnosed with an eating disorder, disordered eating, and that it necessarily looks like, you know, like a cisgender white, like affluent white lady. but increasingly evidence is showing that people with these different like marginalized identities are actually more likely to experience eating disorder and disordered eating and be underserved by the medical community. So I think it's so, so important that we take sort of these different valences into account when we talk about these things, particularly within the athletic community, which is why I'm so excited to see like Tina consistently sort of bringing this issue up. I'm really excited to see continued research in this area and just a more nuanced understanding that it's not just something that like thin gals and race singlets suffer from, though again, like suffering is suffering, and that it's something that we really need to have a much more nuanced and compassionate understanding that sort of takes into account people's different life experiences and levels of privilege when we talk about.
Yeah. And there's also not a linear relationship between performance and weight. Doesn't work that way. And so even if you're not in that situation of being disordered eating or having an eating disorder, if you're measuring yourself based on something on the scale versus how you feel and the results you're able to get, then there's a disconnect.
Exactly.
So we'll wrap our body conversation, our sustainability and our body conversation. And I want to just simply summarize it. What do you think, and going back to Tina, what would you say of that part of the book? What would you point to as the most important lesson if you had to pick one?
I would say that most of us have some kind of tangled, complicated relationship with our body and what it does. And we take for granted just how incredible, I mean, even if you think of picking up a bag of groceries, giving someone a hug, all the little pieces of you that come together to do those simple things. And yet we spend so much energy being mad at our bodies, or being like, I remember, you know, eating an apple in the afternoon and then an hour later being hungry and being like, how dare you be hungry again? I just gave you an apple. Like, you punishing ourselves constantly for like literally our body asking for food or asking for a rest or asking to go to bed early. So I would say that I think the biggest message is that we all have some internal work to do to untangle that relationship between our bodies and who we are. But beyond that, just recognizing that it is not going to be necessarily easy to do because of the messages that we're going against in society. And again, Zoe and I talk in the book about the beauty, the diet industry, what they gain from our insecurities, from teaching us that we are not good enough. So we're going against some incredible forces. So with that, just being gentle to yourself, doing the work that you can, but expecting this to be a lifelong journey and untangling because of what we're up against. So, yeah.
Separating your identity from the things that you do. Okay, quickly, before I continue my conversation with Tina and Zoe, I want to talk about my other sponsor for this episode, Care Of. They're an online vitamin and supplement provider. And so if you want to talk about becoming a sustainable runner, Care Of can help you do that by getting the vitamins and supplements that you need to be your best running self. And the beauty of it is it's all tailored to you and your goals, and it can be modified and adjusted as your needs and goals change. So what you can do is go to their website, take the quiz where you fill out your personal preferences, your goals, a little bit about yourself, and they'll give you a customized recommendation tailored to those goals. And then you can sort through that information, see the science behind everything, and create your customized packs that are personalized for you that will come to you every month so that you don't forget. And that's one of the things I love about Care Of is it makes it super convenient to get the supplements that I need without missing. Vitamin D being one of those, but I'm also now taking ashwagandha and other supplements to make sure I'm my best running self. So go check it out at the website, takecareof.com. I've got an offer code for you. So for 50% off your first Care Of order, go to takecareof.com and enter the code ROGUE50. That's ROGUE50, ROGUE50 for 50% off your first order. Go check it out. And now back to my conversation with Tina and Zoe. So, okay, let's switch to community. I want to talk about this one. And it's so important. Obviously, I'm passionate about it myself. I like to say running is only a solo sport if you want it to be, because it certainly can be. And that's okay if that's what you want it to be, but it doesn't have to be. And I think even those that think it should be could probably benefit from leaning into community a little bit. So I love the second part of the book, talking about ways that people can connect with others through running. But this one is hard, because even somebody who, you know, isn't in a marginalized community might find it intimidating to step into a running group for the first time, or to start a training program, or to try to meet friends through the sport if they may feel insecure about their own participation in it. So Zoe, talk about that piece first. How do we overcome taking that first step to reach out and try to connect in the community?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's just kind of like doing sort of the work in yourself to realize like your pace, your output, whatever it is not your worth. And anyone who were to conflate those two things is an asshole that maybe you need to not spend your time with. Like, you know, it's kind of like any club that doesn't want you for a member is like not a club worth joining. And the great thing about most running clubs is they absolutely do want you for a member, like group runs, whatever it is, running friendships. So often we let our insecurity like get in the way of making that first move of showing up. And like, I'm not saying it's not hard. It is. I have struggled with this. Like, I am an elite trail runner who has like group run insecurity. It's a real thing. I get it. I've had to work through it. But I think that it would be a real shame to let fear of like those things stop you from like amazing, deep, rich relationships and connectivity. And no good friendship starts from a place that's not a little bit vulnerable. And so the great thing about running community and running relationships is they're already sort of premised on that shared vulnerability. And so all of the things that might be keeping you from showing up and like, you know, going to the group run, signing up for that race, those are exactly the reasons that you need to do that, because there's going to be a ton of other people there who have or are working through those exact same things. So it's kind of like, join the club.
Yeah, it's beautiful, I think. And obviously we're evolving and we have work to do to create inclusivity in our sport. But it does seem like, especially over the last 5 years, that we've made a lot of progress in giving places and groups for marginalized communities or those who may not feel welcome a place to be. So speak to that, Brett. The book does a good job, obviously, talking about that. Tina, how is it that even that person who thinks that they're not going to get the support that they might want in our spaces, how can they find it?
Yeah, I mean, we just need to, our sport is evolving so fast, and you just need to look at the explosion of run clubs, run crews. I mean, Austin is a perfect, I mean, how many run clubs, crews do you have in Austin? Like 50? I don't know. It's a lot.
It's more than 50. I can tell you, I have a list and it's at least 75 strong, probably yeah. More than that. And we're adding to it all the time.
Yeah. So Austin is a great example of this, but in most places now you will find, like I was just talking to someone here in St. Louis, there's, you know, a Chinese runners group. There's an Indian runners group. There's obviously all these different, there's, you know, slow you know, call themselves slow running groups. Like Martinus Evans has done amazing work in getting this movement of like slow with his slow AF run club. So I think whatever piece of the running community that you feel speaks to you the most, maybe a part of your identity or something that matters to you, something you feel passionate about, there is probably something in your area, or if you live in a more remote place, maybe there is something at the nearest big city, or maybe there is something at the next big race that you are training for. I mean, I really do think, you know, big marathon weekends are where there's so much energy and buzz, and while it can, you know, there's no denying the fact, as Zoe mentioned, the first time you show up to something and you don't know anyone, it is terrifying. We all feel awkward. Like, you know, all of us feel that way when you're just standing there and you're just hoping someone's going to come up to you. But again, if you found that piece of you, something that speaks to your identity, that group has probably been built on a foundation of, we want people to feel welcome here. And so I would say maybe to start with that, to build up your confidence, because they are going to come up to you because they know what it feels like to go to a different running group and not feel like they belong there. So I would, yeah, really take a moment to think about, you know, maybe when you would explain to people about your running or about who you are, what pieces of you do you feel are important enough? And is there a group that speaks to that in your area? Running stores, running, you know, finding someone who is a passionate runner. Maybe it's a chiropractor in your area. Maybe it's a doctor in your area who may have access to knowing what the groups are. If you have a Chris McClung in your area who has a list of all the running clubs, maybe ask them. But yeah, I think finding the smaller groups is a good place to start.
And if you're not finding it, start your own, as the book points out, because no, it's likely you'll find others that are in a similar place and want to join in. I also like it as you talk about, well, one of my favorite quotes from somebody else in the book, Bill McGibbon talks about activism, and first step to activism is join with your neighbors and organize. Second step is join with your neighbors and organize. Mm-hmm. I love the idea that breeds, which is this idea that if you're looking to have impact, it can be overwhelming to think about trying to have impact on a big scale or connecting to something that's much bigger than you. But just this idea of connecting to someone local to you and organizing and doing even a small thing can make a big difference, and those small things snowball. So Zoe, speak to that concept of just taking those small steps to find people around you that have a similar passion and going to do something about it.
Exactly. So, climate is tough because it's so easy to feel disheartened, or like you're actually like, it's so hard to see like what the, you know, to marry outcomes with sort of your output when it comes to activism and stewardship, that I think it's so, so important to lean into community, because our brains aren't always wired for sort of the labor that climate action requires, which is like years and years and years of like slow, grindy sort of like pushing a boulder uphill types of work. Similar to running in some ways, which is one reason we wanted to like make the case for runners to get into this. But the human brain isn't really wired to function in that way. But one way that we can sort of like hijack that system is by joining with other people, because we do crave that sort of connection. So leaning into the connections that we can build through doing that work is helpful on sort of like a human psychological level. And then when it comes to the actual action itself, what you're able to do as one person is just a small drop in the bucket. That doesn't mean it's unimportant and that you shouldn't do it. It is important and you should do it, but you absolutely can't stop there, because what we really need is the sort of like large scale collective action. So we really wanted to push people to kind of get beyond the sort of like individual framework of assessing how you can help climate, and sort of move towards a place of assessing what are the needs of your community and how can the community service itself in that way, because that's really where you're going to start to see your labor having sort of the impact that we really crave as people, and the impact that we need as members of the sort of planetary community. So, you know, for me, where I live, I'm very, very passionate not only about outdoor access, but also housing access, housing equity and income inequity. So those are sort of like the sort of local political issues that I'm really, really engaged on, but it's going to look different in everyone's area. I think, you know, it's been really encouraging to see how folks in different areas have banded together to fight back against this pushback against reproductive justice and have kind of banded together in those ways. People who are really working sort of in their local communities to fight for housing and transportation justice, and finding, I think, people in communities are uniquely able to assess what the needs of their community are and to deliver on those needs. So I think that that is something that we really wanted to impress upon people, is that, again, all the work worth doing is not really able to be done alone.
Yeah, and I think it's not as hard to find those things as you think, really. I mean, it's talking to people, it's connecting to local organizations, nonprofits, perhaps, that are attached to a cause that you can get excited about. You know, one of the organizations I support here in Austin is called the Sustainable Food Center. It's all about helping local farms create sustainability for their businesses, and then obviously giving them access to be able to distribute their products in ways that are easy for people, so that they can get good, healthy food, you know, that's grown locally. And small thing, you know, not necessarily changing the entire world, but making a difference here locally. And that's something that I can feel good about. What are examples for you, Tina? I know you're full of them for that local action.
Yeah. So I think a good example related to kind of similarly to what you just said is, so someone might hear that and be like, I just don't have time to get involved in a local organization right now. But maybe what you could do is find a local CSA, which is Community Supported Agriculture, which is essentially where you own like a tiny piece of a farm. And so every week or every other week, you would pick up a delivery or pick up an order of fruits and vegetables, local products from that are locally sourced in your area, that sustains you, that helps this farm to continue to, you know, to grow and expand. And then maybe you say to your neighbors, hey, I've joined this CSA. I've been really enjoying it. It's given me some strange new vegetables I've never seen before and forced me out of my comfort zone. Oh, by the way, I made this really good chickpea and bok choy recipe last week, and it was delicious and it's vegan and you should try it. So talking about it is a huge thing you can do. But if you don't have the capacity to get into an organization, that's like a great example of a way to just get going with something so that you can at least start talking about it. And then maybe you share that vegan recipe that you learned from your farm share newsletter with your community. Maybe you take it to a street cookout that you're going to. And so there's plenty of little ways that you can talk about things. I actually just have another good example. Chris, you and I were talking before about our kids about to start school, and I just got my daughter's going into kindergarten, her school supply list. And so on the list was 2 boxes of Ziploc bags. So I was like, hello, just curious what the Ziploc bags are for. And she was like, oh, you know, to send home leftover snacks. And I was like, I will be sending in a reusable one. Like, you know, and so that's a good example. And she was like, oh, you know, we need someone to give us some more ideas. Like just little things like that. My daughter's preschool, I asked them about composting. Could you start composting? And now they're doing it. You know, 200 kids at this school, obviously a lot of waste. They're picky eaters. And so it's little things like that. It doesn't have to be these giant things, but how can you use your access points to just plant seeds in people's minds of what they can do?
Yeah. And if you've never had a carrot recently picked from the ground, it tastes different than what you're getting from.
You mean it tastes different from the little baby carrots that are
right. than what you're getting out of the plastic bag at the grocery store. It's dramatically better. Yeah. So, all right, let's talk about running and the environment. I want to hit on events, travel, gear. So starting with events, talk a lot in the book about creating sustainable events, environmentally friendly events, which is obviously a big opportunity in our sport. I know, Tina, you're involved with Chicago Marathon and their sustainability initiatives, but every race can do little things. So as a runner signing up for events, what should I be looking for and what should I be engaged in conversation with race directors about?
Yeah, that, I mean, that's another example of what we were just talking about there. That is a little thing that everyone listening can do. So you go to sign up to a race, you notice there isn't an I don't want a t-shirt option. You could start with that. Say, reach out to your race director, say, hey, you know, I really don't need another t-shirt. When are you going to add an option like this? That's just one small step to get your foot in the door to make them think, oh, okay, my community's starting to think about sustainability. I better get going on some actions here. A lot of the bigger races, particularly you mentioned Chicago, you know, I work with New York, with Peachtree, a lot of it is getting them to direct their food waste. As unsexy as it is, minimizing food waste as much as we can is one huge way we can minimize emissions. And that is going to make, it's tricky for just someone listening to this to make any kind of change in that way. And that's where I've kind of got these direct channels to these races to help them on the back end. But by emailing your race directors and making it clear that you want this to be a priority. And the good thing is Gen Z coming up are definitely making it clear that they want it to be a priority. Yeah, food waste is one big and kind of easy way that they can begin to make changes to their races and really start to, you know, utilize what is in their community, also supporting the community. A lot of these food waste measures involve food, what we call food rescue. So taking food that maybe would have been distributed to volunteers or people working at the event, or food that is at the finish line of these big 30,000 people event. You can imagine having crate upon crate upon crate of these foods, taking them so that they can be distributed to the unhoused or those who are insecure with food. And so, I think it's a complicated issue, but just everyone listening can start by making it clear to local races that you are involved with, participate in, know that you want this to be a focus moving forward.
And be gentle about it.
Yes. Yeah,
as you guys point out, sure. I appreciate you pointing that out. As someone who's directed races, people can come at you sometimes very angrily about issues. And so, yes, be gentle with your race directors.
Being a jerk is not climate action.
Right.
Be clear. Like getting in someone's DMs and getting up in their face or sliding into the comment section, that is not climate action. Climate action is real, authentic connection where you're both mutually working towards a solution that's been identified as impactful. It's not yelling. It's not emojis, to be clear.
Yeah. Well, a small point in the book, but I appreciate it because I think that's an important part of all of this, whether you're talking to a race director or you're just talking to a fellow participant who may have different priorities than you. We have to speak in kind ways so that people can understand and give them the opportunity to understand versus just trying to cram something down somebody's throat. So,
or being performative. I think something we are seeing increasingly in the space are the folks who are loudest in the DMs or in the comment section are trying to meet their own emotional need rather than working in service of the shared value. So I think just like always be willing to assess in ourselves when you're stepping outside of that value and when you're being performative as opposed to like actually serving the impact.
So let's talk about travel. I know that air travel in particular is a big issue as it relates to climate change and creating carbon emissions. You guys still fly, but pointed out in the book that, you know, it would be better to choose perhaps a different route if possible. So how can we, as we think about traveling to Chicago coming up here in October, New York in November, how do we think about minimizing our impact because of travel?
I think exercising discretion. I mean, for me and for Tina, honestly, like we can't not fly without severely limiting sort of our own chance, like economic security and impact in the industry. So it's sort of this like risk benefit analysis in a lot of ways. And I think that when you've established that you need like be judicious, don't fly if when it's possible to not fly, and try to combine trips whenever possible, say no to trips that you have the power to say no to, and work on, you know, finding a third party verified carbon offset system when you can. I know I've worked with my company outside to help them do an employee matching program for offsetting the emissions associated with employee travel. And I think that that's the sort of short-term solution I'd like to see us all work towards on kind of this more systemic level, while increasingly pushing the transportation energy or the transportation industry to sort of get their act together and start kind of making these larger scale systemic fixes from the top. Because like, even if Tina and I swore here and now never to travel again, the IPCC is not going to redact their report, right? Like, that is still very much happening, whether or not Tina and I sit on the couch for the rest of our lives. But if the entire transportation industry were to make some large scale changes, then we'd really be getting somewhere. So I think it's like, again, always assessing, like, doing what you can do in your own life, but not like internalizing all the culpability yourself when there are still these sort of large scale actors that we can hold account. We can regulate these industries. We haven't. We definitely can. And I think that we should.
Yeah. And I think also you guys pointed out too, just the idea that there's magic in Chicago, New York, Tokyo, all the majors, if we're talking about marathons, but there's also great local races too. And at least for me in Texas, Dallas, Houston, Austin marathons, amazing races. And if you live close to one of those cities, not bad to sign up for your local race either. That can also help the cause. So, and as well as benefit the local community and economy and all of the things associated with the race. So shout out to local races as well. Let's talk gear, shoes, clothes, carbon plated shoes, Tina. I mean, those can't be good for the environment. How do we make good choices there?
It's like you and I had had a conversation about carbon plated shoes before, Chris.
On a long run, I believe.
yeah. Although you'll notice I resisted going too hard into that in the book. but yes, I think gear is something we all as runners can do better on. And I think one of the biggest things to get the message across is that, you know, Zoe had talked earlier about how we are constantly being sold things or pushed things or the latest, you know, get this 2100 XLR ST, whatever watch that has five new features that we don't need. Like, we need to think about what we actually need. And we give some suggestions there for how to decide whether you do actually need something. But we also wanted to make the point that, yes, there's some items we absolutely need. Like, new shoes, yes, that's just going to be a part of a runner's life. Like, and certain items like underwear, you know, socks, you can't really avoid those. But one important thing I think to mention with the running community in general, and again, this ties back to the t-shirts with races, but in general, is we have very much got into this culture in our society that it's better to buy things often and cheap. And just, we just get in this habit of buying cheaper things when things go on sale and when we can find a deal on things. But it really is better to buy fewer items that are high quality, that are long lasting, that are durable, than to buy lots of little things constantly, or to get these new race t-shirts that shrink after three times of using them, or start to break apart, the seams start to go. And then when you have those high quality items, doing your best to repair them, or to find ways to extend their life. We talk about some products that you can use that will help make your rain jacket last a lot longer. Or, you know, we talk about some of the resale programs that are available for people to buy gently used items. And so a lot of it just comes from when you have something, using it for as long as you can, extending the life of it for as long as you can. And yes, resisting the urge to feel like you need to buy the latest gadgets just to improve your running, when, as we talked about earlier in the book, those things in many ways are hindering you, let alone helping you.
I recently took a pair of my running shorts to the tailor because the seam was coming apart, and it was just simply a seam coming unthreaded, and no issue with anything else just got it sewn back together. And I wish I could do that myself, but I couldn't. So I had somebody else do it for me. But
getting clothes tailored. Like, I'm a huge fan of secondhand. Like, I am a fashion nerd. A bit surprising for someone currently dressed the way I'm dressed. Thank God it's a podcast. But I had like a pair of overalls that just like wasn't quite fitting the way I wanted them to. And I was like, this is a bummer because like, I don't want to get rid of them. I don't want to recycle them. And just, you know, spending $40 at the tailor, I was able to get them altered. So there are ways to do this.
Yes. Let's talk about recycling for just a minute, because, you know, I think it's this idea that we all learned as kids that it's a good, you know, I think our generation really helped increase incidents for recycling in the US. It was a kid driven movement, but now we're at a place where we need to take the next step because we're having a lot of issues with bad recycling. Frankly, people not sorting appropriately, recycling getting contaminated, and then therefore whole batches of things get tossed out. China's not taking our recycled cardboard in some cases because it's not quality enough as they're remanufacturing things. So we have to be better. And I know there's other countries that are taking interesting steps here to get better from a recycling standpoint. But when somebody's thinking about their bin and doing things related to it, what are the tips there to make sure that we're doing our part?
Well, I think that the recycling of it all is really interesting because recycling was actually originally invented by the fossil fuel industry so that people would feel more comfortable buying plastic because almost everything used to come in glass and metal containers. And I mean, plastic was essentially invented because it's a fossil fuel product that fossil fuel companies were like, man, it'd be really great if we could sell this leftover byproduct from the oil refining sort of side of things. And they're like, oh, great, we can make it into bottles and put Coke in it. Awesome. Great. And then they noticed people weren't buying it because they were like, well, this isn't reusable in the same way that you would, like, you know, you would set the milk bottle back out for the milkman, he'd refill it. So in order to make Americans more comfortable with consuming plastic, they kind of wholesale crafted this sort of recycling scheme, to use a bit of a loaded term, but it is a bit of a scheme because, again, it was like essentially benefited not really for an environmental reason, but to kind of like launder the industry's culpability through consumers and make Americans more comfortable buying plastic. And it freaking worked because boy, oh boy, are we comfortable buying plastic these days. So I think that is a fascinating history we should all think very deeply about. And that recycling should never, like, I feel like, you know, we're all told this reduce, reuse, recycle, but like, I always, in my head, I rush through reduce, reuse, and I get to recycle and I'm like, great, I'll recycle. But like, that is the last ditch effort, right? Like, we should be much more focused on reducing, buy less, use less, share more, like rent stuff, check stuff out from the library, join a gear library, join a co-op, join a collective, like think about what exists in your community that you can lean into. And again, hard to make friends as an adult, but we've also made it way harder on ourselves by making things so accessible on an individual level and so fewer resources are shared on the community level. Reuse, just get more comfortable reusing stuff. Like, this is not an argument I would make for like shoes, socks, underwear, you know, this is all within reason, but a lot of things we need to get a lot more comfortable extending the life cycle of. And if something you cannot reduce your user of it, you cannot reuse it in the same way that you would like to, that is when you can think about recycling. But again, that is the last ditch effort. And I think that we just need to really, really, really take the pressure off recycling to kind of be our savior in this situation. And I think it's sort of like it should be viewed more as like a harm mitigation strategy as opposed to like anything achieving genuinely positive outcomes. And I think that we should all just like use less and buy things in a more mindful way. Like, buying things in a glass or metal container can be better for, like, uses less carbon in the life cycle of that object than like a plastic container. You know, speaking with companies to like not make their packaging so dang insane. I would say that those are genuinely better ways to spend your time and energy than like stressing out about getting the last little like scummy peanut butter dregs out of the jar so that you can recycle it.
Yeah. And you guys make the point in the book that if you're not sure that you're doing it right, probably shouldn't put it in recycling, because even one contaminated item can throw out an entire batch, which obviously defeats the purpose there. So to put a bow on the environment piece of this. Tina, I want to go to you, which is this idea that this topic can be tricky because people end up in different camps. You know, they might end up in the camp that I know sometimes you've ended up in of really caring, really wanting to do the right thing, but almost being paralyzed by the fact that you can't do it all. Or as you describe in the book, being at a out of town, looking at different restaurants, trying to decide which one would be the least environmental impact to go to and almost being paralyzed by that decision. So that's, you know, a person that might be listening. And then you also have that person who says, well, crap, you know, it's 33 straight 100 degree days in Austin. Like, climate change is here. What can my individual action do? So I'm just going to give up because it seems almost too big of a mountain to climb. So speak to those different reactions to this topic and how to get to how to encourage everybody to take the steps that they can take.
Well, the first thing I want to do is acknowledge that, again, going back to this sense of being imperfect, Zoe and I, even though we are very passionate about this, even though we speak to taking action, we live in the same world as every person living here. And we too use plastic items. We too buy things that come in packaging and we're like, wow, why is this wrapped in three different layers of plastic? I didn't order that. And that is kind of the point to speak to both of those camps, is that when you order something, you aren't asking for the plastic packaging around it. You aren't asking for these things, that there are better ways to do it. So the example I love is there's a company called Blue Land who makes hand soap, dish soap. They make all kinds of bathroom, kitchen products. They package their items in in cardboard boxes. Like, everything, you get these glass containers for your starter pack, and everything comes in either compostable or cardboard packaging. Now, that is something that they didn't have to do, but everyone should be doing, really. But they have taken that extra step to make it a package that is easy to recycle, easy to reuse, easy to dispose of responsibly. But they are making the point that this is how things are supposed to be. And so it ties together in both ways, because we didn't ask for all these plastic additional things. We didn't ask for yogurt to come in a plastic tub. That's just the way it is. So we have to, when someone feels paralyzed, they're going to feel like, well, I might as well give up. And that is this plastic world that we live in. This doomism is all intentional by what Zoe mentioned. The oil and gas, the fossil fuel industry is realizing now, oh, wow, our days are numbered. We need to find a way to continue making profits. And they are channeling, putting all their eggs into the plastic basket. And so while it is not our fault that we got into this situation, they want us to give up because they want us to say, well, there's nothing I can do. My individual action doesn't mean anything. But the one thing that we can do, as you mentioned earlier, Chris, is come together. That is the only way we come out of this situation, is organizing, is saying that this matters to me, is voting with candidates who do put environmental action as a priority. It is, you know, speaking up in any way that you possibly can, recognizing that us pointing fingers at each other, saying, hey, Zoe, you just flew over there, when if you care about environmental action, you shouldn't be flying. Well, those fingers, Zoe and this person is pointing at Zoe, is one less finger pointed at the industry that is causing all the damage. And so while it seems overwhelming, and yes, we are only one voice, like just like a, you know, an ocean is made up of droplets, the more we come together to say we need change, the more the government, the more these 100 companies that are responsible for 71% of global emissions each year, the more they will have to pay attention and start to change. So I would just say, I know that's not an easy, quick fix checkbox answer, but it's just, you know, speaking up when you can, avoiding thinking that your individual action is going to make a difference. But the one thing that does is recognizing that things have to change at the top. And the only way that's going to happen is if we hold them responsible by speaking up about it.
Yeah, thoughtful conversation, awareness. That's action too.
Yeah.
So I want to wrap this conversation with a question that you both answer. One of the challenges with putting out a book is having people find it. And so everybody who's listening to this episode has found it and is going to go get it, Becoming a Sustainable Runner by Tina Muir and Zoe Rahm. What I want you, though, to answer is I want everybody listening to also think about the person that they could give a copy to, or the people they could give a copy to get it in the hands of more people, to make more people aware. So for each of you, if you had to think of a person or profile a person that you might want people to think about when they're thinking about who to give it to that may not find this book otherwise, who would that be?
Man, I feel like me when I was 22 really, really needed this book. I was, you know, a early career journalist in graduate school, pretty, you know, enmeshed in cycles of overwork, burnout, overtraining. But I was also really passionate about the environment. I wasn't sure how those things all fit together. And I would have loved this argument that taking care of yourself can be care for your community and can be care for your climate, and that there is a way to step off the treadmill and that you can exercise agency in those ways. And a lot of times you exercising that agency can empower others to do the same. And maybe we can all build a system that's sort of premised more on mutual thriving than, you know, like, feeds off our insecurity and overwork, and that there is a way, there is a path towards being an environmental steward in the run space. So I would time travel and give it to myself. But I think that this work really is written for anyone who has maybe some passion that they don't know how to direct, or they haven't been able to yet tap into that passion. So I think that's a pretty broad net for us to cast.
I'm going to go the opposite direction, and I'm going to say anyone who is trying to run a BQ. That is the kind of avatar that I give, because these are the people who tend to run headfirst into a wall. I didn't get my BQ. Right, try again. I didn't get my BQ. Okay, try again. But those are also the people who are committed, who are determined, who are focused, who are goal-driven, who the rest of this book can then speak to broaden their eyes, to recognize that they are more than their running accomplishments. They are more than just themselves as a runner, but part of their community. But then also they're the people that get stuff done. And we talk about this in the book, that runners get stuff done. Like, we're the kind of people that would rather spend 10 hours on YouTube researching how to do something than pay $100 for it. Like, we are stubborn. And so that is the group I would say to buy this book for: someone, a friend who is training to run a BQ. So I'm going to go now.
I love it. I like to say, Boston's not going anywhere. Why are you in such a hurry? But I also love the idea of giving it to somebody that you could see yourself in, and maybe that less educated or less aware self. And not that you would necessarily tell them that, but pass on this book as a gentle gift to help them grow. So great answers. Really appreciate you guys taking the time. Obviously, a lot more in the book than we covered. We just scratched the surface. So go get your copy now. And thanks to Tina and Zoe for joining me.
Thank you so much.
There you go. Tina Muir and Zoe Rahm, everyone. Their book, Becoming a Sustainable Runner, comes out on August 15th. You can pre-order it now if you're listening to it before that, or go get it wherever books are sold. Thanks to them for putting out this book to the world on a hugely important topic. Thanks to all of you for listening. As always, you can check us out at roguerunning.com or follow us on Twitter, Instagram, or Facebook at Rogue Running. Until next time, we'll talk to you soon.